This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow wherever you are. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Tortoise. Hello, it's Claudia here, and you're listening to the Slow Newscast from Tortoise. When The Wolf of Wall Street came out in 2013, it set a new Guinness World Record for the number of swear words in one film. There's an F word, on average, 2.81 times per minute. It was a graphic, explicit foray into the decadent and distasteful world of broking. And it's become a byword for the excess and the greed of a city. More than a decade later, it's easy to forget that it was actually based on a memoir, on real life. This week, my colleague Paul Caruana-Galizia has been on his own journey into the world of brokers, and one firm in particular. A firm with a history of lawsuits and its own version of record-breaking profanity.
Who the fuck did it? Come right now! What's the matter, you fucking pussy? Remember the fucking frame?
A warning, if you've not already got the hint, this episode is rated R. Over to Paul.
In the early morning of the 24th of January 2014, Robin Clark arrived at Shenfield Station in Essex to begin his morning commute into the city. As he approached the station, it was still dark. He noticed a man dressed in black, wearing a balaclava, walking towards him. He initially thought it was someone coming to greet him. But the man was carrying a sawn-off shotgun. He fired and blew off a fist-sized chunk of Robin Clark's thigh, missing an artery by millimeters. The gunman ran off and escaped in a vehicle parked nearby. Robin Clark was rushed to Basildon Hospital, where he was put under armed guard. When the police interviewed him, he told them, "I can't think why someone would do this." In the preceding months, Robin Clark had faced trouble on two fronts. He had had to move out of his £2.2 million mock Tudor house after his second divorce, and difficulties at work meant that he had parted company with his employer and started a new job. Until then, he had enjoyed a successful career, rising to become a global vice president at BGC, one of the world's biggest and most successful financial brokers, with offices in London and New York. Robin Clark had amassed a fortune, spending some of it on a collection of luxury cars, including Porsches, Maseratis, Ferraris, and a Lamborghini. His colleagues called him the Wolf of Shenfield. It later emerged there was more to his departure from BGC than first met the eye. A young woman working on his desk, Danielle Victory, also from Essex, had accused him of sexual harassment. She said He'd repeatedly asked her for sex, but one of Robin Clark's colleagues said the accusation was false. The colleague said Danielle Victory made a joke about Robin Clark's tight-fitting jumper and his moobs, and Robin Clark then jokingly teased her about her belly. At the time, no one thought much about the incident. It was part of the red-blooded culture of a city broking firm. A little more than a month later, the police arrested a 50-something-year-old man called Lee Victory on conspiracy to murder Robin Clark. Lee Victory, it turned out, wasn't just Danielle's father. He also worked at BGC. He was upset, it was reported, by Robin Clark's treatment of his daughter. Lee Victory was eventually released without charge. Meanwhile, Robin Clark underwent surgery and spent a month recovering before resuming his new job. Tabloid newspapers loved the Wolf of Shenfield story. It was certainly more colourful than another story about a BGC broker that broke just 4 days after the shooting. On that day, the Financial Conduct Authority banned a former BGC executive from working in finance because he had unlawfully induced brokers to join BGC from a rival brokerage. The FCA said of his case,
"Trust will not be restored in financial services unless professionals within it can be relied upon to act with integrity."
The FCA, the city regulator, has the power to fine and ban companies and individuals in the sector. It has long been worried about brokerages. In the hierarchy of the city, brokers are seen as slightly déclassé. They have a reputation for excess. Investment bankers are seen as the sophisticates. They tend to have attended top universities. They confer with global executives and intricately model their decisions to buy or sell securities. One investment banker, a client of BGC, educated at a public school and top university, told me brokers are lowest down the totem pole. Brokers don't come from the best universities. Many don't go to university at all. The work doesn't require it. They match banks or funds looking to sell blocks of securities, bonds, shares, commodities, with ones that want to buy them. By taking small percentages in commission of these huge trades, they're paid handsomely. The CEO and chairman of BGC, a billionaire who fundraised for Donald Trump, Howard Lutnick, calls the job getting in between the wall and the wallpaper. Brokers tend to be driven and sharp. They are overwhelmingly male and can be seen pouring into the city from trains arriving at Liverpool Street and Fenchurch Street on a weekday morning.
"At the heart of our belief is the principle of freedom under a rule of law. Freedom that gives a man room to breathe, to take responsibility, to make his own decisions, and to chart his own course."
Under Margaret Thatcher's policies of lower taxation, deregulation, and privatization, the city flourished, and so too did the stereotype of a city trader, often hailing from Essex. According to the Sunday Telegraph journalist Simon Heffer, the Essex man was a young, industrious, mildly brutish and culturally barren worker in the nearby financial district, whose roots lay in East London and whose political views were breathtakingly right-wing. Essex men were geographically close to the city, but socially too far from the Brahmins of the investment banks to enter that world. It was typically brokerages that were open to them. Lee Victory, the BGC broker detained on suspicion of conspiracy to murder the Wolf of Shenfield, was originally from East London and then moved to Essex. He was close to the head of BGC's London office, a man from Ilford, East London. A lot of the work of brokers has been automated, bids automatically matched with offers. But brokerage has also persisted as a people business. Brokers wine and dine clients with private concerts, tickets to sports events, extravagant nights out, all in the hope of those clients sending a trade their way. Even among brokerages, BGC is known as the entertainment broker. It's a tough job. Most brokers start early to get to the office at 7 a.m. for another day of testosterone-fueled, sweary trading.
Who the fuck did it? Come right now! What's the matter, you fucking pussy? Remember the fucking brain?
The pressure to win business, of which brokers at BGC typically take half of, is immense.
Nobody wants to fucking go. I'm ready to fucking rip somebody's fucking head off. Yeah, take that fucking thing, naughty. I'll fucking smash your motherfucking head off.
That American man saying he'll rip someone's head off was a credit default swaps broker at BGC's office in 2016. In the video, filmed on the company's trading floor, he swears at anyone who'll listen, until he picks up an office chair only to smash it to the ground. All to the boos and taunts of his bemused colleagues. Bemused because it doesn't appear to have been an isolated episode. 3 years after that video was taken, the FCA wrote to brokerages, saying,
"In our view, brokers have made less progress than other sectors in embedding a culture of good conduct, and so action to raise standards across the sector has become more urgent."
4 years later, in 2023, the FCA sent out another letter to brokerages.
"Frequently in our engagement with firms, and particularly with firms that have been the subject of whistleblowing or enforcement investigations, we have found that poor decision-making and failures in oversight played a key role in exacerbating the extent of any underlying issues or preventing them from being resolved earlier."
The FCA won't comment on specific firms or individuals, but in between those two letters, I know it received two whistleblower reports from two different men who worked at BGC. The first in 2017, the second in 2021. The allegations in their reports were serious. They ranged from poor management and compliance to fraud and embezzlement, the abuse of regulations around entertaining clients, kickbacks to clients, stock manipulation, sexual harassment and bullying, and whistleblower retaliation. A lawyer acting for BGC and its affiliates told me that these allegations, and all others against BGC, its affiliates, and Howard Lutnick that I put to them ahead of publication, were
materially false, misleading, and highly defamatory.
The same lawyer asked me to sign a written undertaking that we won't publish this podcast or any other podcast related to it. We declined. BGC's lawyer added that one whistleblower was
an aggrieved former employee and a serial litigant and prevaricator with a long-time grudge against BGC.
And he said that the second whistleblower was at the time a close friend of the first whistleblower who he coerced into filing his own report with the FCA. The second whistleblower has gone on to say that he wanted to support the first whistleblower, but he has not recanted the allegations he made in his own report submitted in his own name. It's up to the FCA to assess the allegations made in reports it receives. The FCA can fine or ban people who knowingly provide it with false information, and has done so before. Again, the FCA itself can't comment on specific firms or allegations. But on the 29th of June, 2023, the FCA emailed the first whistleblower. 6 years after his first disclosure to the regulator, the FCA told him,
"Substantial work has since been carried out over several years to explore the issues you raised. We have now completed this work and taken a number of actions as a result."
The FCA said, for confidentiality reasons, it couldn't disclose the specific actions in detail, but did say that it had visited BGC, tested whether it met legal and regulatory requirements, and shared some of the whistleblower's disclosures with other UK and US agencies. In summary, the FCA reassured the whistleblower that BGC made material positive changes as a direct result of his disclosures. The FCA added,
"We continue to supervise the firm closely."
In the world of financial regulation, that is a very specific form of words, and ominous. Close supervision is a bit like being on probation. The FCA says that it has between 25 and 60 firms under close supervision in any given year. It regulates around 45,000 firms. The FCA escalates its supervision of firms when it hears of serious failures of culture, governance, or standards. It's typically the step, unless it sees positive change, before an enforcement action like a fine or a ban. OD Asset Management was under close supervision by the FCA for 2 years before the £4 billion hedge fund collapsed. It collapsed in the wake of reporting by us and other national publications on multiple sexual abuse allegations against its founder, Crispin Odie.
It's been 4 days we've been talking about nothing else than Crispin Odie and the hedge fund. What's Goldman Sachs' relationship to that hedge fund?
We're in the process of moving away from that business.
Here too, the supervision appears to have come late. Even before the two whistleblower reports went to the FCA, there was a long history of cultural issues at BGC.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow wherever you are. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
The head office of BGC's parent company, Cantor Fitzgerald, was destroyed in the September 11 terrorist attack on the World Trade Center in New York.
So we lost 658 people, but these were all our friends. I lost my brother Gary, he was 36, my best friend, but that was true of everyone.
Howard Lutnick, who's also the CEO and chairman of Cantor Fitzgerald, wasn't in the office during the September 11 attacks. He was taking his son to his first day of kindergarten.
But all these employees behind us, remember, Cantor Fitzgerald had 2,000 employees on 9/11. We went down to, we started the new year of 2002 with just about 1,000.
Howard Lutnick turned to Cantor Fitzgerald's London operation to rebuild the company. It went into overdrive, its executives often working 20-hour days and not going home for weeks.
So you think, you lost all those people. We've got to help those families. So the rallying cry that rebuilt this company was, you're going to come join us. We give away 25% of everything we make for the next 5 years, and we take care of these families.
By 2004, it had raised $180 million for the families of the 658 workers killed in 9/11. And it spun off as BGC, for Bernie Gerald Cantor.
And now we have 15,000 around the world. We've got Cantor Fitzgerald, we've got BGC, the world's most important wholesale financial service company.
Cantor Fitzgerald's founder had seen something of himself in Howard Lutnick, strivers with backgrounds in the Bronx. He hired Howard Lutnick straight out of college in 1983 and named him CEO 7 years later. Looking back on 9/11, for an interview with the Evening Standard in April 2012, Howard Lutnick and his executives said BGC's culture became less about the money and more about the people. They claimed that it was their new purpose. Robert Beausimon joined BGC in London in February 2012, 2 months before that Evening Standard interview. He was set to make £500,000 a year. After Robert Beausimon refused to take part in an initiation ritual, sprinting across the office while colleagues doused him in water, he alleged in his employment tribunal claim that he was bullied out a year after joining. "Only real men run," he claims colleagues chanted. Another messaged, "I'm going to destroy Bob." But, in the end, the tribunal judge found against Robert Beausimon, because BGC's trading floor was generally, the judge found,
homophobic, racist, and sexist.
And Robert Beausimon was
not the only object of ridicule and insult, nor the sole victim of the abuse. He gave at least as good as he got.
A year after that judgment, in 2015, there was another tribunal claim. Ramesh Kumaran alleged that his manager at BGC sent racist emails about him. One depicted him as Apu, a South Asian character on The Simpsons television cartoon. The tribunal judge dismissed this claim because, the judge found, Ramesh Kumaran took
exception to racial allusions only in retrospect, after his fortunes on the desk had declined.
There are more recent claims. In 2021, for example, a young woman claimed pregnancy discrimination. Her filing, which was shared with me, alleges open cocaine use at a staff party, inappropriate sexual relationships between staff, and bullying. Her case was dismissed on a technicality. And, also in 2021, a man claimed he was forced out of his job when he was suffering from severe depression. He won. But the point here is not whether an individual's case succeeded or failed. It's what the multiple proceedings expose. Despite Howard Lutnick's claims to the press, there appears to have been little positive cultural change at his companies, before or after BGC was spun off. And not since 1999, well before 9/11, when an executive went red, screaming and shouting at a young broker called Stephen Harkaluk from Southeast London. The judge found his boss used the language of criminal intimidators and awarded Stephen Harkaluk a landmark £1 million award in damages. And immediately after 9/11, there was another significant court case. Cantor sued its rival brokerage, ICAP, for trying to poach three of its best staff. It won. But again, the picture painted is what matters. Those three staff described the culture at Cantor as domineering and bullying. One senior broker, Xavier Alkan, wiped spit on a staff member's neck, pressured another to go whoring, and one to go to strip clubs. On the stand, Xavier Alkan described this as common practice for brokers. He said, "On a good night at Spearmint Rhino, you can see 80% of the market." It was after the global financial crisis in 2008 that regulators woke up to the market risks of a macho culture. Policing what it called non-financial misconduct in the sector became part of the FCA's regulatory remit. In 2018, Parliament's Women and Equalities Committee asked the FCA's Director of Supervision whether sexual misconduct is part of her remit. She said,
"Short answer to that is yes. From our perspective, misconduct is misconduct, whether it's financial or non-financial."
For the FCA, a culture that tolerates misconduct, sexual abuse, bullying, so on, is one that tolerates financial misconduct, the kind that harms clients and markets. On the 24th of February, 2021, Howard Lutnick hosted BGC's quarterly earnings call, a requirement for a public company. Shareholders were told that two BGC employees in London had stolen $35 million from the company. 2 months later, BGC sued accountant Mike Finney and senior broker Savia Alkan to recover this money. That same Savia Alkan, who wiped spit on his colleague's neck and pressured him into going to strip clubs. BGC alleged in the High Court that Mike Finney diverted tax rebates due to BGC to his and Savia Alkan's personal bank accounts, and also diverted tax payments due to HMRC to their accounts. The scheme was alleged to have involved doctored emails, HMRC's account details swapped for Mike Finney's at Tesco Bank, Mike Finney using the money to buy his girlfriend, Hallelujah King, Cartier Jewellery, a terraced house in St. Albans, and parking spaces in Leeds. At the start of 2024, BGC settled with Savia Alkan, who claimed to be an unwitting dupe of Mike Finney's. The company is still pursuing its case against Mike Finney, even though he'd admitted to owing BGC millions of pounds and paid large sums back. But questions remain. First of all, how did such an apparently amateurish fraud run for so long? BGC's legal claim said it was 6 years before it noticed the fraud in November 2020, which is inconsistent with what the first whistleblower has shared with me. He showed emails indicating that he had raised internal concerns about BGC's financial conduct while he still worked there. And he showed me legal letters sent on his behalf to BGC informing the company of irregularities with its tax payments. Letters that specifically named Mike Finney, letters sent in July 2017, 3.5 years earlier than what BGC claimed in court, and sent after he was fired. Fired, he says, because he raised these concerns about financial misconduct at BGC in the first place. He claims he was often asked to do work that appeared to breach regulations. BGC told him it was terminating his employment because of his insubordination. Again, the company's lawyer described him to me as an aggrieved former employee and serial litigant. He is currently in arbitration with the company in New York. In 1996, Howard Lutnick acquired near full control of Cantor Fitzgerald. That same year, two of its brokers sued the company in the US, alleging discrimination and bullying. Mark Anderson claimed his colleagues called him a poo stabber, butt pirate, and put a fake vagina with real pubic hair in his sandwich, so that, he claimed they said, he can eat pussy. Stefan Derelian claimed his colleagues hid his prosthetic arm in the fridge and told him that they'd fuck up his other arm. Stefan Derelian did not respond to my request for comment, and Mark Anderson could not be reached. Cantor Fitzgerald said the claims were not consistent with its corporate culture. Both suits ended in settlements by 1999. But the lawsuits against Cantor Fitzgerald, and later its spin-off BGC, didn't end there. There were 6 lawsuits against Cantor Fitzgerald and BGC alleging sexual harassment, stretching from 2007 to 2020, spanning the before and after of the Me Too movement.
4 men were shouting at the top of their lungs, "Kelly D, show me your feet." Again, people laughed and did nothing to stop this blatantly sexualized and misogynistic atmosphere. The general manager made general comments that any successful female broker, including Miss Goldstein, must be sucking good dick.
There were 8 lawsuits alleging discrimination based on race, sex, pregnancy, and disability from 2008 to 2020, including some of the worst racial epithets imaginable.
Jermaine James heard the word directed at him, and his co-workers made monkey noises. Management condoned the harassment.
None of Ashok's co-workers protested against the virulent racism such as fucking and curry boy.
There are 3 lawsuits from 2015 to 2020 alleging harassment and bullying as retaliation for whistleblowing.
John Doe experienced chest pains and dizziness. He feared another heart attack. Although he did not suffer another heart attack, Doe was hospitalized for 5 days.
He used his position as a man in power to degrade, demean, and humiliate Crystal Mitchell. He picked up and threw his boiling hot cup of tea at Miss Mitchell.
No matter the year these lawsuits were filed, or whether they concern an office in New York or Los Angeles, the allegations speak to a persistent pattern, as the most recent sexual harassment lawsuit on record alleges.
After Monique Moriano reported Mr. Mass's sexual advances to Human Resources, Mr. Mass, her direct supervisor, began to shun her, increased scrutiny of her work, and had his subordinates track her and falsely accuse her.
BGC and Cantor Fitzgerald denied all these allegations in court. When I put them to the companies, their lawyer, again, said they were
materially false, misleading, and highly defamatory.
The court record shows that only one of these lawsuits, over a payment dispute, was thrown out by the court. One, over racism and bullying, was forced into arbitration, where BGC lost. Almost all of the lawsuits ended in settlements. For example, Kelly Dunloy's sexual harassment lawsuit against BGC ended with a $500,000 settlement in her favour. BGC part-funded her settlement by taking revenue, effectively personal income, from a particular broker's desk, according to the second whistleblower report sent to the FCA. The report claims the broker was promised a more lucrative role at BGC in return for his financial assistance with the settlement, which is corroborated by WhatsApp messages and a confidential letter from BGC that I've seen. The broker has since said that he just wanted to help the firm out. BGC and Cantor employ thousands of people, and their work is demanding. So you'd expect to see a number of lawsuits and tribunal claims against the companies. But it's not that they've been sued in the US at the rate of once a year since the early 90s that really matters here. It's more that the allegations in those suits are so similar over time, and similar across geography. Similar allegations are made in England. It implies a persistent issue that no matter the number of lawsuits, settled with large amounts of money, the fines and bans, the companies continue to operate in the same way. The allegations of a toxic work environment made in the early 2000s are very similar to those made almost two decades later. The allegations made in the US are very similar to those made in the UK. Over this long period and in both countries, BGC and Cantor Fitzgerald have been run by Howard Lutnick. They are big, sprawling financial institutions, but they are under his control. He owns 60% of Cantor Fitzgerald, the parent company, and a significant share of BGC. One lawsuit over an alleged scheme in which senior employees are bound to divert 10% of their earnings into Howard Lutnick's companies and are then unable to redeem the stock claims,
Cantor Fitzgerald has a relatively flat and thin management hierarchy, so that on information and belief, many of its actions, including business and personnel decisions, are closely or directly managed and controlled by Cantor Fitzgerald's CEO, Howard Lutnick.
But there's another question. Remember what Xavier Alcan said when in court he was asked about pressuring his younger colleagues into going to strip clubs? On a good night at Spearmint Rhino, you can see 80% of the market. The question is whether Howard Lutnick's companies are representative of a sector, brokerage, where these cultural issues are widespread. The world of money has clusters, and they all have their own culture. Investment banking is different to venture capital. Private equity, very different from the branch manager of your local bank. And broking, it seems, still has a culture of its own. Then, even within the world of brokers, the question is how much BGC is the outlier. The FCA certainly seems to think it needs to keep an eye on it. American law enforcement agencies and regulators have fined Howard Lutnick's companies $174 million for financial misconduct under his leadership. The firm's main rival, ICAP, has been fined $84 million, about half the amount. I have combed through employment tribunal judgments, court filings in the US, and spoken to a number of individuals who worked at BGC or Cantor Fitzgerald. Together, these sources paint a picture of a culture in brokerage that needs change. It's why the FCA has long been concerned about it, and why the FCA has, only a month ago, begun asking financial services firms for data on misconduct at their offices, with a particular focus on brokers, which it identified as having more problems than other financial sectors. Yet BGC and Cantor Fitzgerald appear to be taken to court, tribunal and arbitration more than their peers. Perhaps the best indicator of a specific issue at these two companies is that many of their former employees, even the aggrieved ones, have gone on to other brokerage firms where they are happy. The Wolf of Shenfield returned to his new job at a different brokerage a month after he was shot in the leg. On his first day back at work, while on the phone at his desk, three of his colleagues walked up behind him. They were wearing balaclavas, and one was carrying a fake shotgun. They shouted, "Bang!" Robin Clark fell off his chair and his gunshot wound reopened, sending him back to the hospital. But he said, "Some of the guys thought it was a way to diffuse the tension on my return to work. My colleagues have been brilliant." This podcast was reported by me, Paul Caruana Galizia. It was produced by Matt Russell and edited by Jasper Corbett and Keith Blackmore. Sound design by Dominic DeLaghi.
Tortoise. Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pile-ups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit energycitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.
That's a sort of freedom, like an intrinsic knowledge, like you are part ocean, ocean is part you. You have salt water in your body. You are part of this.
Oceans, life underwater. A new podcast all about the oceans and the mind-blowing life within them.
Subscribe now to Oceans, Life Underwater on your favorite podcast app.